Welcome to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, here's your host, Jason Miller.
My guest is Ivor D'Souza, the CIO of the National Institutes of Health's National Library of Medicine. Ivor, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Jason.
So this is a first for me. I haven't had someone from the NLM on before, so let's just start with some basics. What is the mission of the National Library of Medicine?
The National Library of Medicine, Jason, was founded in 1836 and is the world's largest medical library. It's one of 27 institutes and centers at the National Institutes of Health, NIH, located on the Bethesda campus, and is, to many people, mostly researchers, medical professionals, etc., the most visible face of the NIH across the United States and around the globe. And if you think of a library, and as you would expect, the NLM maintains and has maintained over its lifetime a vast print collection of biomedical literature. We have things like rare books, journals, archives, manuscripts, prints, photographs, films, videos, you name it. If it's available in print form, more than likely we have it here. In fact, we have one of the world's richest collections of historical material related to human health and disease. But our biggest claim to fame is really our electronic information resources, which cover a wide range of topics, are searched a billion times each year by millions of people around the globe. The National Library of Medicine is one of the largest providers of online content in all of the federal government. We have around 5 million unique users who access our electronic resources daily, accounting for over 30 million daily page views. Our internet users download around 50 terabytes of data daily, and the average traffic on our internet pipes is 7.5 gigabits per second. And those are just our average traffic rates. Our peak rates exceed well over 22 gigabits per second. And also, if you look at the Alexa Top 100 rating for the busiest government sites on the internet, the NLM is typically the top-ranked site in all of government, except for during seasonal periods. For example, during April, you'd expect IRS to be higher. And during the hurricane season, you'd expect NOAA to be higher. The most popular NLM resource is probably what's called PubMed. That's P-U-B-M-E-D. It contains around 26 million citations of biomedical literature and is very popular among medical practitioners and researchers. In fact, my wife and brother, who are both doctors, and they've used PubMed right from the time when they were in medical school, but they never knew that PubMed was served by the National Library of Medicine. Of course, now they do know, thanks to me. Another public information resource is Medline Plus. It's a web resource geared for patients and their families, and it contains information about diseases, conditions, wellness issues, and all of that written in simple language that even I can understand. And then there is, of course, the popular clinical trials website, which is a registry and results database of clinical studies of human participants conducted around the world. It's a global registration site. And so you can see the NLM is full of interesting things, and it's especially exciting for someone like me who's an IT professional.
Very interesting. A lot of this stuff I just didn't even know about, and it's even more fascinating to learn that not only are you the CIO, but now you have, if you will, customers at home who will let you know when things aren't going the way they expect them to. So that probably makes your job just maybe a little more interesting and fun, I would say. One of the things about the NIH that when you talk about the number of records and amount of information that's downloaded, the traffic on your sites, that all probably adds a complexity to your job as CIO. So talk a little bit about your role as CIO and how do you support that big, broad mission you just described?
There are strategic things that I look at, which, of course, makes us want to align the IT activities along the lines of the mission of the organization. But tactically speaking, there are, I would say, four umbrella categories that I would pay close attention to. The first, I would say, is technology. In the area of technology, high performance and high availability are just very, very, very important to us. Whether we're talking about network and high-speed bandwidth, computer storage, the need for agility in provisioning resources, the need to scale quickly, the need for fault tolerance, we always look at technology for all these particular needs. And we try really, really hard to eliminate single points of failure in technology wherever it is cost effective. We also need to add redundancy in our technology components so that we can be the global 24/7 provider the world expects us to be. The second area that I would focus on, I'd say, is operations. And when you talk about operations, managing the global operations of NLM or running as a 24/7 organization, and all the processes that come along with it. We're an organization that never goes to sleep because we're operating across all possible time zones across the world. And it's important, therefore, for us to have mature processes. You know, how do we introduce changes to our systems? How do we handle incidents? How do we prevent recurrence of problems? How do we establish standards for repeating the good things we do? And how do we create a culture that values continual improvement so we get better over time? A third area that I'd say we focus on is information security, but not in the traditional sense, because we have a lot of online content, applications, websites, etc. Software-based security is very important to us. The traditional model of IT security focuses largely on operating system and network security, but for us, software security is equally as important, if not more important in some cases. I'm very keen on proactive application security, wherein we try our best to build secure software the first time around, so we don't have to spend valuable time and resource to fix issues later in the game once the software has already been deployed. And finally, I'd say the fourth and maybe final aspect where I spend a lot of my time and attention is in people recruitment, retention, and management. Probably end up spending most of my time in this space, being around people, both customers and staff, but particularly staff. Around 90% of our budget goes to paying for Fed salaries and contractor labor. So it's easy to recognize why these people resources are very important to me and my organization. These are the folks that make it possible for us to do all the very good things we want to do to support our organization's mission. And I do feel very strongly that we do take very good care of our people.
Great overview of kind of your role as CIO, the four big buckets. When you look at them, do you break down, do you spend more time, for instance, in operations than you do with the tactical, the strategic side? Or is it, do you try to spend, you know, 50-50 as much as possible?
I spend most of my time dealing with people, whether it's customers, managers, giving face time, and also in the strategic side of things, in drawing out a vision, whether it is a vision for operations or it's a vision for transforming the organization. Operations, even though it is a bulk of what we do, I am very fortunate to have some really able and gifted staff on my team that help conduct the day-to-day operations that don't need me there for most activities. The place where I get involved are when things are cross-cutting, because keep in mind, all organizations are built along functional lines. We have a hierarchy, you know, that has divisions and branches and sections, and they are very good and very efficient in doing the work that they must do to bring about effectiveness and efficiency in keeping with our mission. But there are many times that we have to do work horizontally that is required, that is cross-cutting across these divisions, branches, sections, etc. And it's in those cases where I need to pull the various teams together to work against the non-traditional hierarchical schemes of organizations is where I do get involved to help rally the troops and to energize the troops to help us work more collaboratively to achieve the goals of the mission of the organization.
You talk about your office a little bit. 90% of your budget goes to people, the Fed salaries, the contractor labor. So let's talk about the makeup of your office. How many federal employees do you have? How many contractors? And what is your IT budget for 2016?
I have approximately 160 people working in my organization. Only around 45 of those are Feds. The rest of them are contract staff who work alongside our Feds, and all of them do wonderful things supporting our organization's mission. NIH's NLM's IT staff really work very closely with the program staff who determine the mission and the projects and priorities that we all work on. And many of our program staff are either MD, PhDs, you know, so they have doctors in both medicine and maybe a doctoral degree in some other bioscience field. And so they are experts in medical content, or they are librarians, you know, experts in information acquisition, annotation, cataloging, curation, archival, dissemination of information, et cetera. The NLM IT budget is a little under $100 million, probably in the $95 million thereabout range. But the bulk of it goes towards supporting missions focus systems, and very little of it goes towards supporting, I'd say, internal IT. So a lot of our funding goes towards external customers and systems that we build for external customers of the library.
Very interesting. I know we'll get into some of those priorities and programs in a second. One thing that occurs to me as you talk about the ratio, 45 feds to about 115 contractors, is that a ratio that works, or is that a ratio you'd like to see maybe come closer together?
No, I think that is one of the secret sauces, I would say, of why the National Library of Medicine is very well appreciated for its successes in the federal space. We're very agile because of the makeup. We believe that that makeup is real and will continue. We're using federal positions for mostly managerial positions, core functions, technical leads. We hire some really good federal experts to be managers. Many of them, like me, of course, have had to take pay cuts to join the federal government, but we value the opportunity to provide public service. We have had extensive experience within our Fed staff in their previous, I'd say, private sector careers. And they're able to provide great vision and leadership. But the bulk of the activities of building technology and all the transient, I'd say, temporal skills that change from time to time are being given to the contract staff to perform. And the goal is that good managerial skills, good leadership skills will continue over time and will become more valuable over time, whereas the technology skills are things that are a commodity item that, you know, if you find the best mix of somebody who understands your program and somebody who understands technology, you're going to be able to find it in the commercial space.
And I think that's probably where a lot of CIOs are heading toward, the hiring smart people who can manage people but also manage projects and not necessarily do the nitty-gritty, though I think some may argue you need people to do the nitty-gritty as well within the federal sectors too. So I know there's a different opinions. But let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can jump into your priorities. My guest is Ivor D'Souza, the CIO of the National Library of Medicine. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
You're listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions. Once again, here's your host, Jason Miller.
My guest is Ivor D'Souza, the CIO of the National Library of Medicine. I'm your host, Jason Miller. Now, Ivor, before break, we were talking a lot about how you support the mission of the National Library of Medicine and your role as CIO and the makeup of your office. Let's go ahead and jump into your priorities. You seem to say a lot of your funding goes towards mission-focused priorities, but tell us about what you're trying to get done over the next 6 or 9 months.
We do a lot of basic things, such as infrastructure activities. I know these days cloud technologies is pervasive, and we do some of that as well. We're in the process of evaluating cloud technology solutions on many fronts. Cloud technology, for example, makes a lot of sense to us because it provides high volume storage, large-scale compute, scalability, high availability, geographical diversity of data centers and the like. In fact, we have many cloud evaluations underway. Our cloud technology evaluations involve, let's say, genomic tools and repositories, medical terminology tooling platforms, some archival storage solutions for the library's historical collections, as well as other library-specific functions. But if you look at our mission initiatives, those are really the ones that we focus on more than pure technology-related products, projects, although technology projects, when they provide efficiencies, are valuable to us. I'd like to highlight one where the NLM is in partnership with FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, CDC, USDA, and a few others who are in the health safety arena, where we are collaborating on a project that uses whole genome sequencing that's whole genome sequencing, for the surveillance of foodborne disease. So if you've heard of listeria and salmonella outbreaks, and if you wondered if the government is thinking of innovative ways to get a better handle on this problem, here is a good example of one. So this partnership takes advantage of the NLM's genome database of what's called pathogens. So pathogens are, in layman speak, microorganisms such as bacteria, virus, etc., that cause disease. So they are microorganisms that cause disease. And so we have this big database called the genome database of pathogens. And the FDA uploads pathogen genomes that they encounter during their routine inspection of food plants. They upload those to our genome database. And then CDC uploads pathogen genomes from patients that have the disease. So at NLM now, we end up having pathogen genomes from patients as well as from encounters at food plants. And we're able to look for matches in the pathogen database to see if we can find the same strain that links patients with the food products and their manufacturers. Using this method, we've now been able to detect an offending source within 2 to 3 days, whereas the traditional 30-year-old approach that has been in place has and takes around 2 weeks to detect such relationships. And the good news is that this innovation has already proven itself, even though it is only in pilot. So we've been able to track a multi-state outbreak of listeriosis, which is the disease involving listeria, to certain cheese products from certain cheese manufacturers. And upon detection, FDA issued a recall of the affected products in February. And in March, FDA suspended the firm's food facility registration. So all of this happened while the initiative was still in pilot state. And so we have great expectations that this initiative, when it moves into full production, will deliver the goods as we expect it to. But to understand why this initiative is so important, the CDC estimates that each year in the United States, approximately 48 million people get some form of foodborne illness. 128,000 people are hospitalized, 3,000 die from foodborne illnesses. And with the continued globalization of food supply and distribution systems, it is more challenging than ever to ensure food safety. So we've got many mission-related initiatives that drive our IT program, but this one is very timely because it is kind of hot at the moment. So I thought I'd use that as a good example to illustrate some of the things that are important to us that drive our information technology.
Let me back up to the cloud piece as well. As you said, you have a lot of different pilots going on. Where do you see the shorter, the long-term vision for your use of the cloud? Do you expect to make some decisions about saying we're going to go to a specific private sector cloud, a public sector cloud, or a hybrid cloud? Where is this project or this initiative around cloud going?
Our infrastructure, the way it is built internally, is very, very much in the vein of a cloud virtualized technology. So we've got many of the components internally that mimic what you would see in a traditional private sector cloud offering. But the things that we're looking for are really opportunities to leverage the strength and diversity of offerings of the private sector cloud offerings. And so that's what we're looking at. And the areas that require thorough evaluation are probably twofold. One is where we have a lot of interlinking between our various applications and information resources, just because of the diversity of our applications. We want to find out what is the best fit to be first moved to the cloud, and what can then follow shortly thereafter. So I would say that is one. The second piece is to figure out, whether there is enough of a marketplace to support something that is as extensive as ours at the National Library of Medicine. So what we don't want to get caught in is a vendor lock-in scenario where there is only one vendor who has the ability to support our particular activity. And then when it comes time for a renewal of a contract, we're caught between a rock and a hard place. So those are kind of the evaluations that we're trying to look into to ensure that we have more than one solution that allows us to make a leap into the cloud portfolio, so to speak.
Is there any kind of time frame about when you would make that decision? Are you looking at any kind of contracts or RFPs in the near future?
I don't think time is going to necessarily be a deciding factor. We have to make sure that we find solutions first that will meet the mission goals, although I expect that we would make some progress before the calendar year is up.
And of course, you can always look at other agencies within HHS, within the NIH for their solutions too. And of course, there's always, you know, as I said to one CIO recently, you can beg, borrow, and steal from them too. I imagine that's part of what you're looking at as well.
Certainly, yeah. We're in conversation with many federal partners, including those at the NIH, learning lessons of their experiences and determining where our needs are slightly different and how best to address them. We do feel pretty confident that there are cloud solutions out there that can fit at least some of our needs. And we're actively looking at those things as we speak for various things, including library-specific functions. And so, I would imagine that by the end of the calendar year, we would have made at least a brief foray into the cloud space.
All right. Now, when those vendors start calling you, please don't blame me, because they hear that, they'll get excited. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we can talk more about your priorities. My guest is Ivor D'Souza, the CIO of the National Library of Medicine. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
You're listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions. Once again, here's your host, Jason Miller.
My guest is Ivor D'Souza, the CIO of the National Library of Medicine. I'm your host, Jason Miller. Now, Ivor, before break, we were talking a lot about your priorities. We talked cloud, we talked mission. Part of the priorities you kind of brought up, but didn't necessarily address directly, was big data. And I think the big data piece is huge for the NLM because, as you said earlier, you are a big data agency in so many regards. So talk about the tools, the analytics. How are you getting the most out of your data, both, I guess, internally and externally?
So the NLM is the world's largest repository of publicly available DNA sequences with more than 500 million sequences and 1.6 trillion bases, DNA bases. And additionally, we have over 4 quadrillion bases derived from high-throughput sequencing platforms. And even though these may sound like big numbers, the DNA sequence tsunami has only just begun. But fortunately for us, we have some very bright and talented staff in the genomic space, many of whom are both MDs and PhDs, as I've said before, but who help us curate some of this key information, you know, making it easier for people to consume. So we have done, as a result, put together some annotated or curated information resources that we've built, we've developed, that can help our user population distill the large volumes of information and find the very specific information that they're looking for. And some of the examples of these things, the curated information resources that we provide that make it easier for people to find exactly what they want from this big data tsunami, so to speak, is we've created several resources that aggregate information about, say, genomic variation and their relationship to human health. We also maintain what we call reference sequences of genomes, transcripts, proteins, and a wide variety of species. And these reference sequences are very important for those who are intending to do comparative analysis studies, comparing, you know, sequences one to another, so to speak. And we also provide a set of tools to help researchers find variations or look for similarities across sequences, proteins, and the like. And so all of this work that we have done makes it a little better for those who are delving into the world of genomic big data. And while we're still talking about, how NLM makes its data easy to use, I thought I should point out that NLM for the longest of times has been one of the biggest proponents of open data. You know, we've been in the API business for a very long time. In fact, if you Google NLM API, that's an NLM space API, you'll find a link to NLM's searchable page that lists 292 APIs. So that's a huge amount. And by just looking at the descriptions of those 292 APIs, you'll get a feel for the breadth of valuable information that the NLM makes publicly available.
It's interesting you bring up the open data piece. What do you guys do to ensure that the data you guys also are producing, or at least collecting, is machine readable, can be part of that open data movement where it can be, you know, easy to find at any time, at any place?
The whole idea about creating APIs is, and the 292 that I just listed is the fact that now our data is machine readable. It is meant for organizations to repurpose our, to build software applications and use our APIs and in ways that they envision they would like to use to support their own organization's missions. And the whole journey of going down the path of APIs was to make open data reachable to all parts of the globe with us not standing in the middle.
But do you have a sense that because you're pulling in data from other people as well, other parts of NIH, or you're pulling in data from other agencies, sometimes it comes in structured, sometimes it comes in unstructured. Is there anything that you guys are doing on top of that to ensure that it can be open? I mean, the API is nice, but that's pulling from a data set or making data more accessible. What do you do in terms of ensuring that that data can be found in the first place?
All the API-fronted data sets are structured data sets. Even the data sets that we receive from other parties, a large part of our time is spent curating data, annotating data, structuring data to make it easier for people to consume. And then we take it to the next step where we open it up through APIs, make it easier for people, for computers on the far end to consume as well.
All right, I think it's important because there's a huge push around open data. Number one, to have so many APIs is great. Obviously, I don't think any other agency has as many as you do. And two, you guys are kind of in the business of open data because of just the title of your agency, your mission, National Library of Medicine. Agency like yours has to have open data, has to be very open about it. Are there any tools from an open data perspective internally that you're looking at or that you want to bring to those MDs and PhDs?
Not necessarily. I think for us, open data is about making sure on the outside that the APIs are easy to use, they are intuitive, and they don't need any self-help. On the inside, for our MD PhDs or our IT staff, we're able to support various types of technology stacks to make it agnostic from a technology or a content person's perspective in terms of how they develop APIs. Now, what we do have internally are standard for deploying APIs, but beyond that, we don't put restrictions on technology for how we deploy APIs. Keeping in mind that the NLM mission, I'd say the unwritten mission of the NLM, is to be a provider of high-value content, trusted content, to its researchers, professionals, and patients across the globe. And this production of APIs is and the expansion of use of data into this open data construct is a very important aspect that supports the mission of the library.
Let's jump over to a new topic, information security. At the beginning of our conversation, you brought up this is one of those four areas you spend a lot of time focusing on. And one point about cybersecurity that I thought was interesting that you brought up is it's not just about operating systems and network security, but really application security and the software side of it. Talk a little bit about some of the efforts you're doing around cybersecurity to secure the application side.
What we've done here at the National Library of Medicine is that we've established what I'd say is a balanced program to advance application security, and that takes into consideration three significant areas where we've put in a lot of time. One is secure tooling. The second one, I would say, is best practice processes. And the third, which is probably the most important of all of them, is people development. Now, in the secure tooling area, what we've done is we've invested significantly in source code scanning tools that our software developers use to identify vulnerabilities early at the time of coding itself. So this way, they're able to catch errors, like I said, early in the development stage of applications, and then we can avoid wasting valuable time and resources to fix vulnerabilities once the software is already up and running. So we're catching them early, not while they're running. And these source code scanning tools not only help us uncover security vulnerabilities early, but they seem to be a good platform for teaching software developers good coding practices in general. It not only shows them how to detect vulnerabilities, but also take advantage of the libraries that come into and that are built into the software frameworks that our developers use to build applications. But we realized that tooling and security technology was not the only thing that was going to help us advance to the next stage of good application security. So what we did is we realized early that we needed to also bring in some processes to make sure that technology was complemented equally with processes that would help us do things that technology couldn't muster, so such as business rules that existed in applications were things that humans knew, but tools could not figure out. And so what we did was we decided to implement a secure software development lifecycle. It's called Secure SDLC for those who are in the software development business, and we took on this thing called the Application Security Verification Standard. Its acronym is ASVS, Application Security Verification Standard, which is produced by OWASP, which is the Open Web Application Security Project. So anybody who has access to Google can just look it up and get hold of the standard. The standard is very similar to NIST's SP 800-53 in that it's got a lot of security controls, but in the ASVS, the security controls focus around application security alone. And the security controls are broken down into families of security controls, similar to the 853. It deals with security controls related to, say, authentication, access control, cryptography, input handling, error handling, those kinds of things, things that are specific to application development. And if you look at the totality of all the security controls that exist in ASVS, there are around 207 distinct security controls. But when we studied the security controls and said what of those security controls are applicable to the National Library of Medicine, we realized that only around 46 of those were very, very important to us. And so those crucial security controls, these 46 of those, we made sure that we look at them during the design phase of our SDLC. And so we embedded this into our process. And so now you had tooling that we also included in our development lifecycle. But prior to that, we have now a process, a best practice process of integrating the ASVS, the Application Security Verification Standard, into our design phase of a process. But the final most important thing that we did was take care of training our staff. And we've done several different things, training our staff in terms of applications, et cetera. But here what we did that was specific and of very significant importance to us is that we made role-based application security training mandatory for our staff. Because in the past, there has been mandatory security training for just general users. There's awareness training for general users. There's been role-based security training for managers, for systems administrators, but never before for application security folks. So in that regard, I think we have been pretty unique. And that role-based application security training, what it has done is it's changed the culture of the organization. It's made software developers who previously had been left on the edges of security and never really been required to participate in the security discipline of our organization have now been brought into the fold. So it has changed the culture of the organization, kind of transformed us into really understanding that security is not just within the infrastructure, not just within the physical spaces of data centers, but now security has moved into the software development space. And so this combination of these three things that we've done, which is training staff, very important, having best practice processes, also very important, and giving the user, our software developers, the right tools to do the job have been very important. So that's what we've done here at the National Library of Medicine to improve and advance application security.
A couple things that stand out to me as you went through the list of things you guys have been doing. Number one is automation. It seems like automation is the key to this. Can you automate the software development, the app security pieces as much as possible? And then really focus the staff and developers on more of the more difficult problems. So I guess to start off with, how much of this is automated already?
The source code scanning tools, they're embedded in our software development platform. So if people use Microsoft's Visual Studio or Eclipse or one of those types of IDEs, integrated development environments, the tool is integrated in that. It's also integrated into our continuous integration platform. And so there is a lot of integration where the tool runs automatically, detects issues, and alerts the developers or the QA testers for known issues. And so integration, so that part is always going to be very important because it provides us the benefit of humans making mistakes or having a bad day and missing certain issues that a tool can routinely capture.
And generally speaking, are you guys using this for all applications? Is this just in the pilot stage? How advanced is this in terms of the use of the tools and the training and the like for application security?
For application security, we use this for all our software development. Where we have given higher priority is for the primary, for I'd say the jewels of our crown, so to speak, the major applications, we've given the tools to our developers to integrate with their IDE and with their integrated development environment. Whereas for the, I'd say, the less critical applications, the tool has been integrated into our continuous integration process where it runs before, it runs as the software is checked into the software repository. And we've done this mainly because of cost reasons. It would have been ideal to give every software developer the tools to integrate with their IDE, but the licensing costs for some of these security tools is pretty high.
All right, very interesting. Good stuff. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can talk a little bit about innovation. My guest today is Ivor D'Souza, the CIO of the National Library of Medicine. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
You're listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions. Once again, here's your host, Jason Miller.
My guest is Ivor D'Souza, the CIO of the National Library of Medicine. I'm your host, Jason Miller. Ivor, before break, we're talking a lot about security. We talked a lot about some of your big data and some of your other priorities and APIs. Let's move forward. Innovation is one of those areas where it's happening across all of the government. I came across a challenge you guys are kind of toward the end of called the pill image recognition challenge. Talk about this effort and talk about, you know, more broadly about how this is one of the ways you guys are promoting innovation across the NLM.
So the pill image recognition challenge, Jason, is a NIH challenge that was issued under the America Competes Reauthorization Act of 2010. But before I get into that challenge, I just wanted to say, why is it important? Why are we running this challenge? So it turns out that there's a lot of unidentified and misidentified prescription pills that present challenges for patients and professionals. Because these unidentified pills can be found by family members, health professionals, educators, and even law enforcement folks. And many times, all of them have great difficulty identifying the pills in question. And there are studies that show that 9 out of 10 U.S. citizens over age 65 who take more than one prescription pill and can be prone to misidentifying pills. And as we all know, taking such pills can result in adverse drug events and even cause death. So the goal of the challenge is to find ways to reduce such errors, make it easy for any person to confirm whether the prescription pill or the refill is correct. For example, a person should be able to easily verify whether the color, shape, or text imprinted on the pill, and these are the three major characteristics of a pill, that's color, shape, or text imprinted, are the same as a generic version or equivalent drug that he or she is already taking. And that's really the big driving factor that we're trying to achieve with this. But through this challenge, we're hoping that we will receive high-quality algorithms and software that will help individuals recognize pills based on their color, shape, or imprinted text. And even if you don't get a single entry that excels in all of the three areas, we're hoping that we can combine the ideas of the best entries that we receive and then develop a solution based on that collectively provides a better solution than the individual entries did by themselves alone. And with the end result, we're hoping to be able to provide a freely usable software system and also a freely accessible API that will do image-based search and retrieval from a mobile device. Hopefully, it will come really close to solving this kind of business problem. The submission period of this particular thing, it was open from April 4th through May the 31st, and the winners are going to be announced on August the 1st. And we have four prizes. So we have a $25,000 first prize, a $15,000 second prize, $5,000 third prize, and two $2,500 honorable mention prizes. But beyond the pill image challenge, the NLM has been involved in many innovations over its long and storied history. But the one I'd like to most mention is NLM's role in advancing medical informatics. So in 1986, the National Library of Medicine had begun an initiative called the Unified Medical Language System, known widely by its acronym, UMLS. That's Unified Medical Language System. And the purpose of this Unified Medical Language System is to help computer systems that are involved in biomedicine and health to act as though they understand each other, you know, to be able to speak the language of biomedicine and health. So, for example, if one computer system were to say heart attack and the other system were to say myocardial infarction, the UMLS lets them both know they are talking about the same thing. The UMLS is a full medical ontology that not only tracks which terms mean the same thing, but they also track the relationships among illnesses, medical findings, medical procedures, medical treatments, medical drugs, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see that something like this is a very popular resource in the field, and it's very easy to see why that is so. But what if I told you that IBM's Watson supercomputer that destroyed its human competition playing Jeopardy on TV also used the UMLS under the covers to answer health-related questions? Now, when I first heard about it, I said, like, wow, that's great. But the truth is, the NLM is not entirely surprised that that happened, but it was very gratifying to find that IBM used the National Library of Medicine's Unified Medical Language System. And the reason I said we're not very surprised is because it is hard for us to track all the innovative things that have been sourced by the National Library of Medicine. And many times it is through some roundabout way that we find out all the things that people have done using the many valuable resources that the library brings to bear. But we're just very happy to be part of somebody else's journey towards innovation.
That's fascinating that IBM's Watson is using that. Does it mean that they're using that standard language to help solve specific health-related questions, as you said? So what does that mean for NLM? Anything? Or is it just, a kind of a feather in your cap saying you all developed a language that is universally accepted in many ways?
I think it's more a feather in our cap. I do not know the specifics of how they've used it, but certainly the acknowledgement that they have used the UMLS was something that the National Library of Medicine is very proud of.
Ivor, unfortunately, we're out of time. I know we could probably talk a little bit longer. My guest, Ivor D'Souza, the CIO of the National Institutes of Health's National Library of Medicine. Ivor, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much, Jason.
Thank you for listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions. The entire show is available on demand on federalnewsradio.com. Search Ask the CIO.